This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Somewhere in the misty past, Homo sapiens became the first and only animal to recognize its own mortality. The search for immortality started shortly thereafter. Close to 3,000 years ago, Chinese alchemists believed that liquefied gold could prolong life for those willing to drink it. In the 1500s, legend has it, explorer Ponce de Leon went in search of the Fountain of Youth. He found Florida instead. In more recent years, we've come to a much better understanding of how and why we age and what we realistically can and cannot do to avoid the ravages of time. Most of us now accept that immortality is out of the question and that we will only be 29 for exactly 1 year. But that has not dampened our enthusiasm for longer life. If we can't stop death, maybe we can postpone it for a while. Scientists are working to respond to the demand for longer and healthier lives. The business world is scrambling to figure out how to profit from it all, and politicians and ethicists are debating how scientific developments challenge how we think about life and what it means to be human. Later in the program, Spanish scientists hope that DNA tests will finally put the issue of who lies in Christopher Columbus's grave to rest, and the biggest baseball scandal in Chicago since the Black Sox. But first, the scientific search for longer life. If you have questions about the science, the politics, or the marketing of life extension, give us a call. What would you change about the aging process if you could, and how might scientific success change things? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Stephen Hall is the author of the book Merchants of Immortality, Chasing the Dream of Human Life Extension, and he joins us from our bureau in New York. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, Neil.
And wanted to ask you, to begin with, where do we stand with the question of life extension?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, immortality has been a timeless interest of human civilization. I think what makes this particular epoch different is that you have a convergence of the baby boomers, for example, who are confronting mortality, I think, for the first time in themselves and also with their parents, and a rise in hardcore molecular biological approaches to some of these issues. The science has gotten much better, much more interesting. It certainly has produced no medicines yet, and that's a long way off, but the fundamental understanding of some of these processes is starting to look pretty interesting. So great progress is actually being made.
We sometimes forget that great progress has already been made in extending lifespans. Over the past century, it's almost doubled, really.
Since 1900, the average expected life expectancy in the United States has risen about 30 years, which is a remarkable achievement, and it's one due to a variety of factors, including just better medical care, vaccination, public health, hygiene, that sort of thing. The notion that we could extend it further by biological intervention is kind of where the new frontier, and I just thought this would be an interesting area to explore, so I went to talk to a number of the people who are doing this research and the entrepreneurs who are pushing it in the private sector and so on.
You describe this. I mean, this is a fascinating moment where all of this stuff, the stuff you're writing about, has really taken shape. Well, you know, some of it, obviously, over the course of the 20th century, now into the 21st, but much of it in the past 20 years or so.
Yeah, I trace in the book kind of the history of how gerontology became of interest to molecular biologists. And the story has its origins a little bit in the 1960s, and a guy named Leonard Hayflick discovered that when you grow human cells just in a lab dish, they reach a certain point and then they senesce, or they just stop growing and replicating. And this suggested that there might be some biological control to the process of aging. As it turns out, and there's still a debate going on even today about the meaning of those results, whether that means that cells are destined to die or not, and whether this actually applies to organisms as opposed to cells grown in a lab dish. What it did do is suggest that there's a biological avenue to begin to understand these processes, and it took a while for that avenue to be pursued. It really wasn't until the 70s when some of the molecular techniques like recombinant DNA became available that you could start looking at this in a somewhat more systematic fashion. But that's kind of the beginning of when people started looking at this.
Mm-hmm. It was fascinating because when you talk about his discovery that there was only a certain number of divisions in a cell that were going to happen, the Hayflick limit is the terminology, that before that, scientists thought that those cells were functionally immortal.
For a long time, for many decades, beginning in the beginning of the 20th century, it was widely believed that cells were immortal unless you did something wrong to them that caused them to die. And so when Leonard Hayflick came along in the 60s and said, wait a minute, these cells are dying or stopping their growth without any intervention, people disbelieved it. And so he had quite a struggle just to get people to believe that, in fact, cellular immortality was not a fact of life, but exactly the opposite.
And, of course, you also go on to describe that some kinds of cells, of course, are immortal.
Certain cells, cancer cells, for example, which kind of override the mechanism that prevents cells from replicating indefinitely, are considered immortal. So, too, are germline cells that allow us to procreate. And also stem cells, which is, of course, have been much in the news lately. They have this ability to kind of override the Hayflick limit and continue to replicate even in laboratory plates. So there are certain exceptions to the Hayflick limit.
We're talking about the timeless subject of immortality. Our guest is Stephen Hall. His new book is Merchants of Immortality, Chasing the Dream of Human Life Extension. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to the phones, and our first caller is David, who joins us on the line from Richmond, California.
Yeah, I think this is great. I'm excited about this kind of research. I grew up glued to the TV set during the Apollo program and have always been a big proponent of the space program and space migration. And given how we're probably not going to have faster-than-light travel anytime soon, this is the kind of breakthrough that would allow humanity to spread out through the stars.
That's an interesting idea. Stephen Hall, how much of a life extension are people actually talking about?
You know, people always ask that question. I think it's almost impossible to say precisely what might happen. The only guide we have, and it's actually not a terribly useful guide, is in experiments that have been done in animals. But that avenue of research has actually been very interesting. Researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, Cynthia Kenyon is one of the leading researchers in the field, and Leonard Guarenti at MIT, have discovered a particular pathway where if you genetically alter that pathway and tinker with it a little bit, model organisms, that is the simple lab animals that scientists use to test these ideas, can double their lifespan or significantly extend it. Sometimes it's 30, sometimes 40%. Now, to extrapolate that to the human situation, I think is a leap that's not warranted at this point. Nonetheless, the suggestion is that if you interact with a metabolic pathway, or in this case a growth regulating pathway in living organisms, and it's now been shown to be true also in mice, you may be able to affect some degree of life extension. Now, one of the caveats I always raise in this is that people say, well, the mice are perfectly normal. Until we can interview a mouse and ask them how they're feeling and if there are not side effects that were not immediately apparent to us, but nonetheless the animal may be suffering. And I think it's hard to make the leap and say they're perfectly harmless to the animal and it has this effect. Nonetheless, you can see experiments in which this effect takes place, and it's very encouraging because this is done by credible, highly successful biologists who are enormously respected in their field. As you probably know, the field of immortality and life extension has been dogged throughout its history by this kind of aura of quackery.
That's the other thing that David mentioned in his question, faster-than-light drive, and once immortality was pretty much lumped into the same category.
Exactly. And I think for many, many years, even in this century, anyone who talked about life extension was kind of looked at a little cross-eyed as if they were nuts. That began to change probably about 10 to 15 years ago. And even then, it was viewed with considerable skepticism. But again, as this body of knowledge began to develop in the basic research community that there might be something there, there's been increasing interest and attention paid to it.
David, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. There was another aspect of his question that I was interested in, and he talked about NASA and the idea of big science. There's a moment in your book where you're going back to describing Dr. Hayflick and the first discoveries of this and how they were then developed by a Russian scientist whose work was overlooked pretty much for 20 years because it was in an obscure journal and then went on to another group of researchers, many of them women, and how congenial this field was and how productive it was in terms of cross-fertilization, and then big money and big scientific prizes got involved in the process.
I think that's a recurrent pattern. I've written a lot about the sort of history of contemporary science and genetics and molecular biology, and it's a truism of the field that as soon as something, its profile becomes a little bit higher, everybody becomes interested in it. And by everybody, I mean everybody. It's not just other scientists. It's entrepreneurs. It's venture capitalists. It's people like us in the media start mm-hmm. paying much more attention. And it kind of creates this little insular weather pattern around a particular intellectual pursuit, and everybody pays a lot more attention, and things get a little bit more competitive and a little bit more probably secretive, certainly when companies become involved. And it changes the kind of the general sociology of the field. I think that happened in this particular case as well.
There was one moment you describe in your book when one of the female researchers was about to present her paper at an important conference, and the guy who was on in front of her just went out and stole her thunder.
Well, it didn't steal any of her work, but I think he was so enthusiastic about it that he started talking about it. And that the point is, when science reaches this kind of critical point, or a field does, it's kind of a little bit like a mosh pit, and people just start jumping in, and they start making assertions, not with any ill will, but they're enthusiastic, and they jump right in. And the fact of the matter is, science works because it is competitive, because it is kind of like a relay race where the baton is passed, and it's not just one person doing it. It's the fact that there's so many different groups all trying to achieve the same thing that actually drives it and makes and that competition moves things along faster.
Hmm. We have an email question from Esther. I've signed up for cryonic suspension when I die with Alcor, she writes. That's the organization that has preserved Ted Williams, or the body of Ted Williams. Hmm. I believe this is a valid form of life extension because I plan to do it in the hope of technology will eventually be able to repair bodily damage and extend natural life. What's your opinion of cryonics, she asks.
I didn't really get into cryonics because it took the story a little bit away from what I'm more interested in, which is the basic research going on in the laboratories and then the translation through a kind of time-honored pattern from biological labs at universities into biotech companies. And then as the biotech tech companies become larger, they sometimes get absorbed or merge or so on. But it follows a sort of pharmaceutical pathway as opposed to cryonics, which is a little bit separate. Cryonics, it seems to me, is basically a holding action, literally and figuratively, until the cure can be discovered or the remedy can be developed.
You mentioned that the mice have never been able to be interviewed, those whose lifespans were doubled. But as scientists look at it, I mean, is it just that old age is extended for another lifespan, or is everything, is childhood also twice as long as it was?
Well, actually, that question is really insightful because it raises the kind of more global issue related to this: is what exactly are you extending, and what is the quality of the thing you're extending? I think everyone agrees that if you extend lifespan or average life expectancy without an improvement or maintaining a good quality of life at the same time, you really haven't gained much. And I think you have to think about these things in a somewhat more sophisticated fashion than just that life is going to be extended and you're going to live longer. And one of the analogies I use is if you've by some way are able to restore the vigor of a 20-year-old to a 120-year-old person, but you haven't cured Alzheimer's, what have you ultimately gained? You have a bunch of young people that forget everything.
We're talking about the quest to live longer, not just a scientific inquiry, but a business proposition now, too. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the science, the business, and the dream of life extension. Our guest is Stephen Hall. He's the author of Merchants of Immortality, Chasing the Dream of Human Life Extension. He's with us from our bureau in New York. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Janine, who's in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a biologist, and I just wanted to point out that throughout the animal kingdom, there are good experiments showing that if you calorie-restrict animals, you can extend their lifespan significantly.
Just, in other words, reduce the amount they eat.
That's right.
Stephen Hall?
That is, it's interesting that you bring that up. Those original experiments were done in the 1930s, and it's been the only generally accepted way to extend the lifespan of a mammal. Those experiments were done in rodents, I believe, at Cornell University. What's interesting about some of the more recent work that I mentioned with the insulin-like growth factor gene, this is the genetic manipulation, it actually intersects with the same pathway that's involved with caloric restriction. So a mystery that's been kind of hanging over this field for 70, going on 80 years now, there seems to be another intersection of it in the modern molecular biological approach. So I think that's another reason that these results are being viewed with a fair amount of credibility.
Janine, was there any indication of how pleased those animals were to have their calories restricted all that time?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm actually practicing that regimen on my dogs, and they are hungrier than they'd like to be, I'm sure, but they're also healthier.
Well, I guess that's the side benefit, and since they can't complain in writing, you're in good shape.
That's right.
Okay. Janine, thanks very much for the call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Let's go now to Stephen, and he's with us from Minneapolis.
Hi. Yeah, my question, as I'm listening, I'm thinking of that margarine commercial or that butter commercial where you don't mess with Mother Nature. And given there are cells that stop functioning and there are cells that don't stop functioning, what do you suppose the consequences are for messing with the ones that perhaps are doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing?
Interesting question again. I think that, first of all, I don't entirely agree with you because I think we mess with nature all the time. Every time somebody goes to a doctor, goes to a hospital, has an operation, takes a medicine, we're messing with nature. And I think we all agree that intervening in that respect is a good thing and not a bad thing. The larger question you're bringing up is, are we getting into something we shouldn't be getting into or messing up with something we shouldn't mess with?
Isn't this the end of all of those Boris Karloff movies where somebody at the end says there are things mankind is not meant to know?
Well, we may find that out. I actually think a large part of the research that's going on is dedicated to a somewhat different but similar goal, and that is to prolong healthy life. And by prolonging healthy life, I mean perhaps reducing some of the damage of aging so that people can live more active and healthier lives in their later years. And that actually kind of merges back toward the factors that have extended average longevity over the past century. Now, there's just better medical care. You can make the argument that regenerative medicines like stem cells, which are not online yet, but maybe in 15, 20 years from now, actually are kind of form a bridge between traditional medicine and a medicine of life extension. I mean, all medicine is life extending in the sense that it preserves lives. I mentioned the book. My mother was one of the first people in the United States to receive penicillin in the 1940s and had a kind of life-threatening infection. To my mind, penicillin is a life-extending drug because, she's still alive today because of that drug that she took in 1945. So I think we have to broaden our sense of what it means to extend life and what medicines qualify under that kind of rubric. Hmm.
Stephen, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Wanted to ask you about a couple of characters who are in your story. Of course, they're not characters, they're real people. But we mentioned Leonard Hayflick already for his scientific contribution. But there was a critical legal contribution that he made as well that really did change this entire field, indeed a lot of science.
Leonard Hayflick is a very interesting character. He's an excellent scientist, and he made this unexpected discovery in the 1960s. And these cells instantly became sought after by scientists throughout the world. I mean, he was literally sending these out as a cottage industry from his laboratory, which is then at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia. At a certain point, he retained ownership of the cells, and the issue of who owned the cells came up as one of the first intellectual property disputes in biology, and at least in modern biology. And he refused. He began to sell the cells to various researchers, basically out of his garage. It was a mom and pop operation, basically. You know, not making a profit on it so much as just reimbursing his own costs for doing so. Ended up getting into a big lawsuit with the NIH, and that lawsuit was settled out of court, but it's viewed as one of the kind of landmark decisions that allowed biology professors at any university to take the reagents that they develop in their university labs to the private sector to develop in a biotech setting.
Yeah, at one point there's a great scene where you describe him leaving, I guess, Philadelphia at one point with all of his stuff, his cell lines stored in way below zero in a cooler in the back of his station wagon as he drives off to California.
Right, he drove across the country. He had this liquid nitrogen container, you know, strapped in with the seatbelt in the back seat, and he drove across the country with a couple of his kids, and was then working at Stanford University. And at one point, the government actually broke into his lab and confiscated all the cells because they claimed he was basically selling government property. Hmm. Now, what's really interesting about those cells is that when Hayflick developed them in the early 60s, he realized, and other people realized, they came from human fetal material that had actually been shipped over from Sweden. And he realized that type of cell would actually make the preparation of childhood vaccines much safer than the cells that they were using at the time, which were animal cells like monkey cells, for example, that contained viruses and God knows what other contaminants. And so those cells ultimately, and cells like them, were ultimately used to prepare a whole new generation of vaccines that probably almost everybody in this country over the age of 30 has benefited from. Hmm.
Then there is another character, and he comes into the equation when the science has been more advanced, and this is a guy named Michael West, a fellow who you describe as the born-again Darwinian.
I describe him that way because Michael West is a very interesting character with an interesting background. A lot of people may be familiar with his more contemporary role because he's been one of the major advocates for therapeutic cloning. In the late 1970s, he was a molecular biologist looking around for business opportunities in this area. But even before that, while growing up in Michigan and after attending college, he became a creationist. He actually believed the biblical version of creation.
This posits that the Earth is only 6,000 years old.
Exactly. And then kind of attacked that reasoning in his own mind until he convinced himself that it could not be true, and that in turn led him to consider the notion of immortality and aging and whether the death was necessarily inevitable according to the biblical expulsion from the Garden of Eden and so on. So there's a very interesting intellectual and religious background to his gravitation toward this field. Mm-hmm. He ultimately founded the first company, the biotech company that was devoted to aging research. It was called Geron. That was established in the early 1990s in California. He's now associated with a company called Advanced Cell Technology in Massachusetts, which has, again, been very involved in the cloning story. And one of the interesting aspects about its founding, before West got there, three researchers from the University of Massachusetts founded this company. One of them was named Abel Ponce de Leon, and he actually was a very distant relative of the 16th century explorer.
Let's get some more callers involved. Dara joins us now from Portland, Oregon.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if there's any forethought of how this, how the implementation of this technology is going to occur, who is going to have access to it, and if it's just going to be another situation where people with privilege are going to be able to have it. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay, Dara, thanks for the call.
That's an interesting question. I think this is ultimately, first of all, I think it's very important to say it's very early on in this whole story, so there's nothing that's going to be at your local pharmacy in the near future. But this does become a component in the larger healthcare debate, which is, you know, what's accessibility, who's going to get it, how much is it going to cost, and what the social cost of it may be as well. I mean, if this is successful, or even if it isn't, because I think the trend is still that more people are going to be enjoying life into later age just as a result of this better medicine, how is that kind of lopsided demographic going to affect the society that we live in? It's going to affect things like social programs like Social Security and Medicare. Family structures are going to be affected by it. So the impact is going to be on a broad front, and it's the affordability is only one of those issues. But I think that's a good question, because these things will not be cheap when they're initially introduced. Mm-hmm. In fact, there may even be a black market at first, because I'm sure there's a certain pressure and interest by some people to get their hands on this kind of medicine very quickly, whether it's been successfully tested or not, proven to be safe and efficacious or not. So,
here's an email question sort of follows up on that from Kurt in Renton, Washington. Is it possible that increasing overpopulation would lead to political pressure to suppress research into life extension?
That's a degree of speculation it's hard for me to arrive at. It's an interesting question, because the large block of elderly voters that might result from this kind of technology would inevitably affect our politics as well. It would affect job hierarchies. It would affect all sorts of things. My general sense is it's not going to be quite as dire as all the futuristic scenarios suggest. These things tend not to be as dramatic, and they don't quite unfold in exactly the way the most dire scenarios suggest. Nonetheless, it can definitely have an effect on some of these issues, like politics, how people vote, the patterns in which they vote, the blocks and programs they support. So it certainly could have an impact in that area.
Let's go to Anthony, who's on the line with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that I spend probably 45% of my patient load, I'm a podiatrist, is over the age of 65, and the older they are, the only question they ask me is, why am I still here? And because of the myriad of problems that they have. And the second question is, a book by Larry Dossey states that it's really not medical care that is responsible for increasing longevity, but that it's public health measures. Would you care to comment on that? Thank you.
Yeah, let me address the second part first. I mean, in a sense, I agree with that. I mean, public health, when I think of public health, I think of vaccines. I think of, you know, regular medical checkups.
Sanitation, clean water.
Sanitation, housing, you know, the whole gamut of intervention. But some of those are definitely medical, and so I wouldn't entirely agree with that. In terms of the problems that the patients over 65 complain about, this gets back to the point I made earlier, that a certain degree of sophistication has to be brought to this issue. It's not going to be a matter of taking a single pill and then all the problems are going to vanish. And if you do not globally attack all the various ailments of the elderly, you're merely going to be funneling everyone toward the ones that you can't cure or at least arrest in some way. So one of the companies that was working in this area reported a result in the paper about 5 years ago about making cells immortal, and they got a call from somebody in the public the following day asking one question: how big is the pill going to be? And it's a funny question, but I think it also adverts to how these issues tend to get simplified and oversimplified very easily, and I think we have to look at them in a slightly more sophisticated fashion.
Well, also going back to Anthony's point about public health, obviously the other factor that has helped people in the past 100 years live longer has been better nutrition.
Exactly. And getting back to caloric restriction, eating less. I mean, this is a very simple approach. And again, it's just been something that's been pursued in animals. But a near starvation diet, as unpleasant as that sounds to our ears, nonetheless, it seems to have good health effects. One can surmise that it might have things to do with oxidative damage, because of the more metabolism that's going on, there's more damage to the DNA in the cells, and that the cumulative effect of that over a lifetime would be to probably lead to dysfunction and some of the ailments that we associate with aging. But you're absolutely correct that good nutrition is a factor in this. But I think that almost is a quasi-medical intervention, because Having the scientific basis and knowing which foods are more nutritious and what they do for you informs the decisions of the kind of diet that we maintain.
We're talking with Stephen Hall about his new book, Merchants of Immortality. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's go to Lori, and Lori's on the line with us from Brookline, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi there. I'm just wondering, with all this talk about extending our lives, does that also cover our skin? I have not seen anything at all, any progress being made whatsoever in stopping the way we age on the outside. I mean, as you know, our skin becomes paper thin as we get older, and I'm not exactly sure I want to extend my life another 30, 40, 50 years looking like I'm walking dead, but not really dead.
Right.
And you know how important that is to women. Plastic surgery is $1 billion business.
I'm just realizing the old Dick Tracy character, Prune Face, could
right,
become the,
exactly.
the poster boy of the
It really affects your happiness, and who wants to walk around like that?
Well, it's an interesting point to raise because it has not been addressed, but it does fall in this kind of general purview of, for example, regenerative medicines like stem cells. But it also is something that needs to be addressed by basic research. I mean, understanding the process of aging gives you some inroads to possible interventions that might delay it, might reverse it in terms of skin deterioration. It's an excellent question, and I know there are a lot of people that are working on it. I don't think it's come to the point where they have the answer yet, but
Dr.
it's again...
Dr. Turcone thinks that if you, I don't know if you've read his book, but he says that if you eat lots and lots of salmon, you're going to stay young.
Don't know about that, so I better not comment.
Okay.
Young but stinky.
Okay, well, I hope you work on that. It's important to us women.
Okay. Lori, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we get another call in before the break. Jeremy's in Beaverton, Oregon. Jeremy?
Yes, sir.
You're on the air.
Hello. My question was, viruses, if they enter and absorb into cells and they absorb the cell information, and if the cell no longer is limited by age, would the virus also mutate and no longer be limited by age?
Ooh, boy, I don't know. Stephen? Okay.
Off the air.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I don't know the specific answer to that question, but viruses, as a rule, are not limited by age anyway. They're basically need living cells to reproduce in, and so as long as there are living cells to reproduce in, they reproduce, and if they're not, they don't. Hmm. And I think it would not matter what cells they were available for that process. So.
Here are some of the headlines today at NPR News. In Jordan, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon pledged to dismantle some Israeli settlements, and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas pledged an end to terrorism against Israel. We'll have a report on that later today from NPR's Peter Kenyon. Also, the firestorm over the Pentagon's use of intelligence on Iraq. Did the Defense Department slant its analysis to push for a war in Iraq? The Pentagon says no. Members of Congress are looking into the matter, and interview with Senator Carl Levin about that later today on All Things Considered. When we come back from our break, we'll finish up our conversation with Stephen Hall about Merchants of Immortality and the search for human life extension. And we'll also take a look at a couple of other stories. Scientists in Spain hope that DNA tests can conclusively prove whose bones that actually reside in Christopher Columbus's grave, and we'll be going to Chicago to look at the big controversy after Sammy Sosa's bat exploded at Wrigley Field yesterday and revealed that he'd put cork in it. Big scandal. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the science and the business and the ethics of human life extension. Our guest is Stephen Hall, the author of Merchants of Immortality. And let's get some more listener questions. Eric has been a very patient on the line with us from Lansing, Michigan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had kind of an ethical comment / question. If we continue to raise life expectancy by artificial means, or if these artificial means of life expectancy are realized, do you think that there are implications for the long-term sustainability of the Earth as a whole? Not just talking about the United States, but if we realize that the human population on the Earth of over 6 billion people is probably one of the greatest threats to the long-term sustainability of the planet and the resources, do you think that this is possibly maybe an unethical pursuit at this point in time? And maybe that if these technologies, as one of the previous callers stated, might be only available to those of the upper classes or those in industrialized nations, and those nations are the ones who consume more of the resources, do you think that would further skew that problem? Hmm. And I'll take my answer off here.
Good questions, Eric. Thank you.
Yeah, the latter part of that question actually is quite astute. And the issue of who's going to benefit from these technologies, clearly they're being developed in developed countries, but not necessarily Western countries. For example, a lot of the work in stem cells and cloning is going on in China, also in Israel, England. The technology looks sufficiently appealing, and by that I mean looks like it might have some value. The people are pursuing it there. Balanced against that are these alarming and depressing statistics from in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world that average expected life expectancy is dropping. I think in over 40 countries it is, and largely because of HIV infection. There's this real sense of creating a kind of lopsided demographic of well-to-do, wealthy and healthy people in developed countries and not in developing countries that don't have access to these medicines. In terms of the carrying capacity of the planet, I don't know a specific answer to that. I know that I talk about what some of the actuarial societies are doing in terms of following all this development, and that's one of the issues that they raise. So it's a good one to be focused on. Whether that constitutes an unethical pursuit of technology, it's hard to say. I mean, one of the points I make, it's more apropos of the cloning debate, but it extends, I think, to your question as well, is that just as there are no atheists in foxholes, I don't think there are any idealists in a hospital bed. Once one is confronted with mortal illness, I think the notion of what's the ethical decision for the whole of society is probably not paramount on your mind, which is not to say it shouldn't be or it's not an important consideration. But I think a lot of these things are driven by the decisions that we reach with ourselves when we're in a position of vulnerability.
One last question. Let's go to Christine from Athens, Ohio.
Hi. So nice for you to take my call. I've enjoyed everything that people have said, and I've sort of had my wind stolen by the time I've gotten here. My concerns were political and humanitarian, environmental as well. But does this mean, since I would have extended time, that I don't have to clean out the closets this weekend?
That's a technology that has not specifically been addressed, but I will be glad to provide my phone number to be first in line.
Christine?
Yes.
You've got my permission.
Oh, good. Well, I figured if I have that extended time, that maybe I could just put it off for another little while. No, it's a very exciting topic, but once again, I do have my thoughts about that ugly American role that we are beginning to play more and more on the face of the earth, and I suppose it's yet another frontier, and looking forward to reading your book.
Ugly Americans, maybe, but neat.
Yeah.
Very neat.
Very neat.
Yes.
Yeah, especially our closets.
Christine, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
We appreciate it. And Stephen Hall, we appreciate your time today as well.
My pleasure.
Stephen Hall is the author of the book Merchants of Immortality, Chasing the Dream of Human Life Extension. It hits bookstores next week. He was with us from our bureau in New York.